"They are here," said Agali with that calm certainty Vika had always envied. "Do not despair. This is their land. In Orsia they first made themselves known, and from here they spread throughout the world. They are in the very earth beneath your feet and the air you breathe. If the aspects are silent, it is because we have forgotten how to listen."
"But I heard them before,"
Vika cried, surging to her feet. Ruk raised her head, startled, as she stalked away from the fire in agitation.
"I heard them clear as a bell. They appeared before me, as real as you are now."
"I know," said Agali. "I remember the day I found you. A child whom half the village thought touched by the gods, and the other half thought possessed. They didn't know whether to worship you or drown you."
"And you took me and taught me and sent me out to teach those who would hear what wisdom we had."
She came back to the fire, snatched up the liquor and took an angry swig.
"And my reward? The aspects stopped speaking to me. I dedicated my life to them, and now they lie supine while some foreigner's god sweeps through the land, razing all our faith has built."
She threw out an arm as if to take in the whole of the night.
"So tell me, Agali, those visions I saw in my youth, were they just some hysteria of the mind? All these portents and omens, is it the gods and spirits that grant them, or the poison herbs we drink? Are we all mad? Did the apostates have the right of it?"
"Do not speak such foolishness," Agali snapped, rising to her feet and snatching up her staff, eyes hard with fury in the firelight. With her red-streaked face and the goat skull suspended in the dark beside her, she was suddenly fierce.
"Doubt the aspects if you will, but do not invoke the apostates. They have corrupted and perverted everything we stand for, and I will not hear it from one whom I thought wiser."
Ruk was on her feet, barking now. Vika held Agali's gaze in defiance for a moment, and then looked away, ashamed.
"Forgive me," she said quietly. "You are right. I spoke in haste."
She walked to the edge of the stream and stared across it to the far bank, where the trees gathered close and the glowflies blinked in the darkness.
"A month before you found me," she said, "I met Hallen in the fields and walked with him. He told me it would be a good harvest, and that the blight would end that year, and so it did."
She looked over her shoulder sadly at her mentor.
"I know I saw him, Agali. He was there, tall and blonde, with a crown of wheat and barley, a cup in one hand and a sickle in the other. Just to be near him was a comfort and happiness so profound I will never again experience the like. I knew the aspects existed then, as sure as I knew there was ground beneath my feet."
She felt a wet nose at her hand, then a warm tongue. Absently, she scratched the top of Ruck's head.
5 times I was visited by the gods. 5 times, and then no more. Can you imagine that? To be so blessed and then not to be?"
"I have never seen them," said Agali. "Only their signs and agents. Be grateful for what grace was given you. We are each tested in our own way." Vika looked into the babbling water. She was no longer angry, but sad instead. Her moods had always surged and faded suddenly. Emotions crashed upon her like stormy waves on the rocks, and it was hard to know how much of it was her and how much a result of the potions she'd been taking most of her life. You didn't get to walk in the Shadowlands without paying a price.
"I believed you had been sent by the Aspects that day," she said to Agali. "I think if you had not come, my neighbours would have killed me."
She gave a faint smile.
"Now I think of it, you did not look much younger then than you are now. 25 years it has been, but you've hardly aged a day in my mind."
Agali laughed.
"You're no lore keeper either," she said. "Your memory plays tricks on you, I think."
But Vika heard mischief in her voice, and she wasn't so sure. She put a hand on Vika's shoulder.
"Doubt is healthy, but do not give up hope," she said gently. "The Creator did not put us here to solve our problems for us. The giants cursed the long ice, I suspect, yet from that disaster came the 6 races.
Once we were all enslaved by the Erds, and then came Jessa Wolf's Heart, and soon we had built an empire. Each setback makes us stronger." She squeezed Vika's shoulder in encouragement. "The torments are the servants of the aspects. It matters not that the gods did not show themselves in person. You were chosen as the bearer of great tidings. Do you not see that?" Vika nodded. She felt churlish now. For all her complaining about the aspect's silence, she'd seen them 5 times more than most. Others with stronger faith had never been shown such proof. "Why do they not call a conclave?" Vika asked helplessly. "We will know when they do. Perhaps your news will inspire them. I will spread the word, as should you." "It will be too late by then," said Vika. She tipped her head back, her hair falling away from her face. Few stars were visible through the knotted canopy, but Vika didn't need to see the sky to know the night. "The communion is breaking. It took me longer than I expected to find your druid sign and track you. The stars in my vision were those of an autumn night not long from now. Whatever is coming will happen then."
"Then you must go at first light," said Agali. "Go out into the land, and let your feet lead you where they may. The aspects will guide your steps. Your fate will not find you in the deeps of the old wood." Onward, ever onward. Vika felt the stone on her heart grow heavier.
"And what will I do, Agali, out there in the land?"
Agali smiled. "You will find our champion."
20. The next day was Festen Day, and morning found the prisoners lined up in the yard for convocation. Festen Day prayers to the Primus were obligatory for all subjects of the Empire, and most forms of work were forbidden. Despite the tragedy that had befallen them, some of the prisoners still grumbled at their luck that the mine was closed on a day which they were due to have off anyway. But they were cheered by the rumour that mining wouldn't resume for at least a week while the engineers made it safe again. They sang to the Primus with gusto after that, though the Croden hymns they'd been forced to learn by heart meant nothing to most of them. Aaron stood among them beneath a bright cold sky, listening to the priest give his sermon. To outside eyes, he was anonymous in the crowd, another pale figure in ill-fitting grey clothes, shivering and underfed. But today he felt transformed, steely with purpose.
"Do not grieve," the priest was saying, "for your brothers have joined the Primus in his light. And was it not said by Thomas that if a man toil for the glory of Croda, whether he a farmer or warrior be, let all men call him noble?"
Aaron stared at him with loathing. He was a soft, portly man with the milky look of someone who'd been roundly bullied as a boy. He wore beige and red robes, beige for parchment and red for blood, stitched with Croden rays across the shoulders and chest. The blade and open book of the Sanctorum hung round his neck, wrought in gold.
"Shut your mouth," he thought fiercely, heated by defiance. "All your talk, what does it mean? They didn't believe in the Primus, those men who died. You put them there, you and your people. You killed them, and you nearly killed Cade too."
"Their toil is ended, their earthly sufferings over," the priest continued. "They are beyond the reach of the Nemesis now, and the crimes that brought them here have been burned away in the radiance of the one true God. Let those of us who remain honour their memory with the strength of our backs, and redouble our labours in service of the Empire, that their sacrifice will not be in vain."
Overseer Krent lowered his head in pious agreement. Captain Hassan swept the assembly with a keen gaze, alert for signs of dissent. The guards surrounding the yard fidgeted and looked bored, while the archers up on the wall kept an eye on those below. Nearby stood the scratched and blood-stained pole where uncounted prisoners had been eaten alive, clawed to pieces by Croden skull dogs. Aaron stopped listening and turned his mind to his plan. There were two gates out of the prisoner's compound, one to the east that let into the guard section, and one to the south that opened onto the bridge over the river and the village beyond. Both were heavily guarded and securely locked when not in use. Carts were searched, going in and out. He'd briefly wondered if they might smuggle themselves to freedom that way, but it would require Raffa's cooperation, and he'd have nothing to do with that pirate. He was still angry at him for giving ragweed to Cade. Besides, he had nothing to offer in exchange, and the risk was too great that Raffa might betray them. No, they were going over the wall. Sneaking out after curfew would be easy. The camp was dark at night, and the patrolling guards were simple to avoid. Getting past the vicious skull dogs was the challenge. The area they patrolled was divided up into fenced sections, with three dogs in each to ensure they were evenly spread around the perimeter. But three skull dogs were still three too many, and all they had to do was bark to raise the alarm. Still, if they could get past the dogs, it wouldn't be hard to clamber up the wooden scaffold to the archer's walkway on the inside edge of the stockade wall. During the day, the archers were alert and watchful, but at night, when their commanding officers were abed, they drifted about idly and chatted. With luck and guile, they might slip past them in the dark. But he had to reckon on facing at least one, and they were all big, well-fed and carrying short swords. Perhaps he and Cade could overpower a man like that with surprise on their side, but he wasn't at all sure of it. Once past the archers, they'd have to get down the outside of the stockade without breaking a leg. That required rope, and time enough to tie it. Then all that was left was the escape through the mountains, with guards and skull dogs tracking them and winter closing in. They'd need food, warm clothing, weapons and supplies, and even then the chances of survival were slim. But it could be done.
"The Primus loves not the laggard," said the priest. "He grants no favour to the prostrate man who pleads. But he who has the will and strength of character to strive, on him does the light of the Primus shine."
"I'll strive all right," Aaron thought, addressing the Primus. "I'm going to strive right out of this hell you put me in, and I'm taking my friend with me. Stop me if you can." It felt good to shake his fist in the face of a god. He'd always been afraid to before, scared that some misfortune would befall him if he questioned what he'd been taught. But misfortune had befallen him anyway. What good was piety then if it won you no favour? He brought his mind back to the matter at hand. Scorning the Primus and his servants got him no closer to his goal. There were things to attend to before he could put his plan into action. And the first of them was grub. He found the Skarl in the crowd and felt hate and fear stir in him. The marks of their last encounter were still bright on Aaron's body. Stealing his cheroots had only been the latest in a long line of abuses and humiliations. Aaron never knew when Grub would turn up next, to take his food, to rob him or beat him. Maybe next time he'd take something really vital, or put Aaron in the infirmary. Grub had come to the camp soon after Aaron, and as near as Aaron could make out, he had no friends here. He did, however, have plenty of victims. Aaron was only spared worse bullying because Grub picked on weaker prisoners more often. He chose the young, the feeble, and the unpopular. Cade had been overlooked because he made other men laugh and they might decide to defend him. Aaron had no such protection. He'd mostly kept himself to himself because he believed the other prisoners were traitors and criminals who likely deserved to be here, because he believed Croden justice didn't make mistakes. Unwittingly, he'd made himself an easy target. If his plan were to even get off the ground, that ended today. The prisoners dispersed once convocation was over. Without work, most of them would be gambling for contraband, cutting deals, hustling for survival. Others would talk, pray to the aspects, or tell tales. The little things that kept them human in this inhuman place. Aaron watched Grub as the crowd broke up into groups, and when the Skarl headed into the alleyways between the longhouses, he followed. "To overcome your enemy, you must first understand him." Master Oryk's favourite maxim, It was time to put his teachings into effect. Aaron knew little about Grubb, but he knew something of Skarls. They came from Skarathun, to the northeast of Embria, a hostile white wilderness of giant saber-toothed beasts and blood-drinking witches. Their tribes had existed in a state of permanent conflict over their limited natural resources until one visionary leader, Thal Iqbar, began the tradition of the scattering. From that day on, the firstborn of each family were cast from their tribes when they reached adulthood and sent across the seas to other lands. While the rest defended and cared for their homeland, the firstborns won glory for themselves and their people, so that one day they might return heroes. Feats of arms, mercantile brilliance, labyrinthine cons, acts of soaring romance. The object was to make a story of themselves and have it scribed on their skins, that the bone god might read it when they died. In the process, they'd win renown for their people, and, ideally, return with great gifts and wealth for their tribe. The greatest among them were honoured with towering sarcophagi, their legends inscribed on the sides, and placed among their ancestors in snow-bound necropolises that sprawled across the frozen plains. Aaron knew he had a shallow understanding at best, but it was all he had, and any advantage was better than none. Milling knots of prisoners, relieved to be released from convocation, clogged the routes out of the yard. Aaron dodged through them, keeping Grubb in sight. He had compact, thick legs and a lumbering gait, but he moved fast for all that, and Aaron struggled to keep up. Once, he thought he'd lost him, but then the back of that bald head bobbed into view again, half covered in those black, crawling tattoos that chronicled the deeds of his life. As they made their way further from the yard, the crowd thinned, and soon the way between them was clear. Grubb appeared to be heading for the graveyard, but Aaron wouldn't let him get there. It was time to make his move. The Skarl was walking with his head down, apparently deep in thought. Aaron quickened his step to catch up. As expected, Grubb turned behind a longhouse in the direction of the cliffs. Aaron rounded the same corner and found to his surprise that he had vanished. He halted, staring at the empty space between the longhouses, a simple muddy path walled on either side with flaking planks. There was no cover here, nowhere to hide, nowhere to go. The apparent impossibility of Grubb's disappearance blanked Aaron's mind, and he stood there, gaping. Then he heard the scrape of a boot from above, and looked up just in time to see Grubb dropping down on him from the longhouse roof. He reacted fast enough that the Skarl's first blow didn't land true. Instead, he was smacked across the shoulder, shoved hard by his attacker's weight, so that he slammed palms first against the side of the longhouse opposite. Before he could turn, an arm wrapped around his throat from behind. He struggled, but the Skarl was stronger, and it was like pushing against an oak. Panic sparked as his throat was crushed in the crook of Grubb's arm.
"Think Grubb doesn't know what Mudslug is up to?" Grubb snarled in his ear. "Think Grubb doesn't see Mudslug follow him? Mudslug looking for Grubb's stash, yes? Very brave or very stupid. Grubb thinks he knows which."
"No," Aaron gasped, his eyes bulging. "Talk. Came to talk."
"Grubb believes you. That sounds very likely to Grubb."
Aaron fought unconsciousness, his head going light for lack of blood. He was hit by the chilling realization that Grubb might not let up. He could die right now, and he was helpless to prevent it.
"Stop!"
He could only grab snatches of air.
"Want to trade?"
"Trade? You trade with Grubb? Grubb takes..."
Then the arm was gone from his throat, and Grubb turned him round and shoved him back against the longhouse wall. Aaron sagged, dizzy with relief, hauling in air as Grubb patted him down and rifled his pockets.
"What Mudslug got? It better be good, or Grubb break something Mudslug not want broken."
Aaron labored to get the words out.
"Not in my pockets. Going to give you new tattoo."
Grubb stopped searching, his eyes narrow within the ugly black crescent that crossed his face.
"Mudslug better make sense quick," he warned.
Aaron put a hand to his aching throat.
"Your tattoos," he said. "Each one tells a tale of your mighty deeds."
"Mighty deeds," Grubb roared in agreement.
He jabbed a finger at a line of hieroglyphs running along his collarbone.
"This one, say how Grubb climbed down cliffs with his men to surprise camp full of Boscan smugglers. Then when their ship turn up, Grubb surprise them too. Get plenty rich."
"You've done great things," said Aaron. "You'll be a hero when you return to your people, I bet. And you'll make fine reading for the Bone God when your time comes."
Aaron saw something flicker across Grubb's face, a fleeting expression that might have been uncertainty or fear. Whatever it was gone as quickly as it came, and as Grubb's features darkened to a scowl, Aaron sensed he'd made a mistake. He plunged on before the scowl could hit him.
"What I mean to say is, are you finished?"
"Huh? Finished?"
"Well, your whole right arm isn't filled in yet. Half your face, too. Seems like there's still space for great deeds, but I can't see much opportunity for heroism here. So, is that it? Are you done?"
"Grubb is not done," Grubb snapped. "Grubb not dying in here. Grubb will make such a story that the Bone God marvels at his deeds."
"You want to do something your bards will sing of?"
"Yes."
Aaron leaned forward.
"Then this is my trade. Help me, and I'll cut you in on my escape."
Grubb stared at him long and hard, suspicion and threat in his gaze. Then he took a step back and dusted Aaron's shoulder with the back of his hand.
"All right," he said. "Now Grubb is listening."
21. The autumn fogs came often in the high passes of the Ostenbergs. The next time they did, Aaron was waiting. It was an hour past curfew. The light had left the sky, and the camp was muffled and stilled. Gauzy murk stirred in the spaces between the darkened longhouses, and most of the prisoners were abed, snoring and sighing in their bunks. But for Aaron, there'd be no rest tonight. He sat on the edge of Cade's empty bunk while he laced his boots, his breath steaming. 4 days had passed since the explosion in the mine. 4 days of healing, resting, and planning. His bruises were mostly faded now, the swelling in his face gone down. He felt stronger than he had for a long while, both in body and mind. Cade was getting better too, not that you would know it by the way he screamed down the infirmary several times a day. His madness had mysteriously passed, but in its place he suffered inexplicable and agonizing pains throughout his body. Dr. Barden was at a loss as to the cause. The only thing that helped was a spoonful of Draken tears to sedate him and ease his pain. Kel fretted about giving him too much. Draken tears were a powerful drug and lethal in excessive doses, but nothing else worked. She need not have worried. As soon as she left his bedside, Cade spat the Draken tears into Aaron's water flask. It was already half full. A little more, and they could put their plan into action. Aaron had been assisting with the wounded when he could, both out of a genuine desire to help and to keep in touch with his friend. In the quiet moments, they had the opportunity to talk. Outwardly, he was the Cade of old, quick to joke and to mock himself, friendly and easy in his manner. But Aaron sensed he was in fragile spirits under the mask. All his hopes depended on Aaron, and thoughts of escape were his only refuge from despair. Aaron felt the weight of that responsibility, but knowing that Cade trusted him gave him courage. He moved between the bunks, feeling his way to the door. His fellow prisoners were blue shadows against the shuttered windows, made anonymous by the dark. Some raised their heads as he passed, but none spoke to him or tried to stop him. He'd be far from the first to steal out after curfew on some secret errand. The longhouses were not locked. Instead of bolts and padlocks, Captain Hassan had a simple rule. Anyone caught outside after curfew without a pass would be fed to the skulldogs the following morning. No excuses, no exceptions. For most, it was an effective incentive to stay inside. Aaron had heard tales of prisoners forging passes, but if they existed, they were beyond his influence to obtain. He'd just have to be careful. The fog wasn't as thick as it had been last time, but it was full dark, and he could barely see anything. He slipped through the chilly murk with nervous speed, pressing close to the longhouses, heading for the graveyard. Tonight, he meant to have a reckoning with a spirit. Not a spirit. The dead are the dead, and they don't come back. It was just a boy. A boy who'd survived, alone, for 2 years or more within the walls of the prisoner's compound. It felt easier to believe Rags was a shade, but Aaron refused to accept that. His faith in an ordered world had been shaken, but he wouldn't embrace the folk wisdom of his ancestors in its place. He was still scared, regardless. The shifting fog made his eyes unreliable, showing him movement where there was none. He calmed his breathing and listened instead. There was little to hear in the eerie quiet, but the song of the blood in his ears. A creak of leather broke the silence. Aaron peered around the corner of a longhouse, his heart thumping hard. The noise came again, closer and then closer still. It was unmistakably moving towards him. He tried to fix the direction, but the fog thwarted him. Suddenly, there was a brightening of the murk, and a shadow moved. A guard walked out from around the corner, carrying a lantern, and in fright, Aaron flattened himself against the wall and went still. The guard passed by within a few feet of him, oblivious to his presence in the fog, and Aaron, to his amazement, remained unseen. He didn't move until the creak of the guard's leather armor had faded into silence. Only then did he dare to detach himself from the safety of his hiding place and go on. He tried not to think of Degan as he went, but he couldn't help recalling his screams as the skull dogs went at him, the way his flesh fell apart beneath the dog's red claws and teeth. "They won't take me alive," he promised himself. "I'll throw myself on their swords first." But the gap between intention and action was always wider than he thought, and he wondered if he'd be brave enough for that. He reached the strip of open ground between the longhouses and the graveyard and struck out across it. This time, as the walls on all sides disappeared into nothingness, there was no sense of clutching dread, and he climbed over the graveyard fence with a small sense of satisfaction. Once among the graves, he felt more confident. The guards didn't patrol the graveyard. It was easy to turn an ankle on the broken earth or fall into a hole in the fog, and even the relentlessly sensible Crodans were not immune to fear of the supernatural on a night like this. He crept towards the cliffs at the back of the camp. Lifeless trees, twisted as in torment, were feathered with roosting crows. Cairns of piled stones and leaning planks commemorated the dead. He picked his way between humps of earth, listening hard, but nothing moved among the graves, and no spirits rose to attack him. He stopped deep in the heart of the graveyard, judging this spot as good as any, and sat down, leaning his back against a tall cairn. "Well," he thought, "here I am." Cade had told him a story once about the Blood Mare, a horse spirit with fanged teeth and bladed hooves that could bewitch travellers with its prancing. The enchanted travellers would climb on the blood mare's back, and it would take them on a wild ride through the forest, which would end when it bucked them off a cliff or plunged them into a river to drown. Then the unlucky traveller would be eaten. It was pure Ossian folklore, though Cade had dressed it up as Croden for Aaron's sake. In the story, a clever hunter learned that a blood mare might be lured and pacified by the song of a virgin girl. He set his daughter to the task and hid nearby, hoping to slay the beast when it arrived. The blood mare came as expected, but unbeknownst to the hunter, his daughter wasn't quite as virginal as she'd claimed to be, and the tale didn't end well for either of them. There were no such thing as blood mares, Aaron told himself, but sards were real, and their love of music was well known. He remembered the unsettling tune Rags had been singing when they first met. Now it was his turn. He took a breath, let it out. He was trembling and only partly from the cold. Then, in a small, thin voice, he began to sing. His nannies and tutors had taught him Croden songs and hymns in praise of the Primus, but they wouldn't do here. The song that came to his lips instead was an Ossian one, sung in the gliding tongue of his homeland. It was known as the Mourner's Elegy, a song of loss, a celebration of a life together, and a chronicle of quiet intimacies shared. To the unknowing, the grieving singer might have been a farmer, or a merchant, or a lord, or anyone who'd ever loved another to the limit of their ability. But there were hints to the truth in the verses. The dead woman was Jessa Wolfsheart, the greatest leader and hero Ossia ever had, and the man singing was Morgan, her lover and companion. The Mourner's Elegy was a personal portrait of a woman otherwise known only as a legend. It had been long since Aaron had sung anything at all, for he wasn't fond of the sound of his own voice, and there had been little to sing about of late. It had been longer still since he sang in Ossian, and the first verses came out frail with fear. He risked being overheard by a guard, if one came near enough, and he still had doubts about trying to lure Rags this way. He couldn't quite forget the sight of the shaggy-haired sard boy eating raw crow. But there among the graves the song found him, and it sank into his chest and warmed him like whiskey. His voice strengthened, and he closed his eyes and abandoned himself to the music. If he was to be heard, let him be heard, by friend or foe alike. There could be no half measures. This song, this course he'd set himself on, was life and death. He wouldn't shrink from it. Time slipped away from him. He didn't know if his voice carried in the fog-shrouded night, or if he was the only one hearing it. Only when the song had finished did he come back to himself, and his voice quivered into silence. He opened his eyes, and his heart bucked against his ribs. There, crouching in the dark, was Rags. He was half hidden behind a plank, his green gaze piercing in the gloom. Aaron's mouth went dry as each watched the other, and neither moved. "No ghost you are," the boy said at last, in heavily accented Ossian. "Neither are you," said Aaron, and saying it broke the spell. It was only a boy, after all, and his fear left him. A twig cracked somewhere in the fog, a muffled Croden curse. The boy twisted in alarm, then turned back to Aaron. "You come," he said urgently. Aaron needed no second invitation. There were Croden guards in the graveyard. They'd heard the song. He scrambled to his feet, and together they hurried into the fog. 22. The boy led Aaron through the graves to the foot of the cliffs, where a tangle of evergreens and shaggy vines grew close against the stone. There, he pulled aside a low branch and wriggled through the narrow space. Aaron followed with considerably more difficulty. He emerged, arms scratched and clothes torn, in a tiny hollow between the trees and the cliffs. Crammed in with the boy, he could smell the stink of him, old sweat and mould. "Safe," said the boy. "Come." There was a rustle of movement, and he was gone. His disappearance startled Aaron, who could see no way out of the hollow beyond the way they'd come in. He found himself alone in a distressingly tight space, with cold rock at his back and trees pushing in on him. He began to paw about, carefully at first, but then with increasing panic as claustrophobia took hold. Cade's tales of trickster spirits came to him again, and he imagined himself caged here till he starved, lured to his doom by a shade in the shape of a boy. Then movement again, and the boy was back, seizing his wrist in a warm grip. "Come," he said impatiently, and tugged Aaron. He felt about and found a corner, a fissure in the cliff that he'd somehow missed in this tiny space. The boy backed into the crack like a spider, still tugging at him, and Aaron crushed himself down and followed. As he did so, he caught sight of something painted on the rock, a strange twisting symbol of curves and slashes, dense with meaning, stark and clear despite the darkness. After he went inside, it stayed floating before his eyes for a time, like an afterimage of the sun.
Come, come, the boy said again.
Aaron felt along with his hands. Fabric brushed against his face, making him jump. A crude curtain hanging in his way. The boy pushed it aside and guided him onwards.
Come, careful be.
Can he see in here? Aaron wondered, but that was ridiculous. The darkness was total. The boy simply knew the space like a blind man knew his home.
Stay,
the boy said, and Aaron did, surrounded by the void. The darkness and confinement should have frightened him, but he felt himself calming instead. He'd found the boy, and he was real. That was a victory. A flint sparked. The wick of a rusty lamp caught and warmed into life, filling the space with a comforting glow. They were in a small cave, barely big enough to stand in, which was cluttered with junk and bric-a-brac and scattered with clothes. Piles of mildewed blankets were heaped untidily at one end like a nest, and there were bloody black feathers everywhere. In a crevice in the rock, arranged like ornaments on a mantelpiece, were the boy's treasures. Coins, a ring, a handful of teeth, some damp cheroots. There was a pile of small round stones in a hollow off to one side. Ammunition for his sling. Aaron looked about and marvelled. To find such a place here, hidden away in the joyless world of the camp, was like slipping through a portal into some shabby wonderland. Though it was freezing and dank and resembled the lair of a scavenging beast, it was a secret place, right under the noses of the Crodans, a place they had no power over. Its very existence was a rebellion. The boy settled back on his haunches, scratched his dirty scalp and gave Aaron a shy smile.
Ethan,
he said, patting his chest.
Aaron,
said Aaron and did the same. How long have you been here? Ethan shrugged.
When the others they are taking, me they are not seeing, he said.
He spoke in sing-song tones, the way all sards did.
I make it so.
You hid? Ethan shook his head, his filthy locks bobbing about his thin face.
I make it so they are not seeing.
He patted his chest again.
Idral, Idral.
Aaron didn't know that word and wasn't sure the boy had understood his question, so he let it go.
I like your cave, he said.
Now he was here, he wasn't quite sure how to proceed, and it seemed best to be friendly. Ethan grinned, showing brown teeth.
Your song I like. In the past I hear.
You've heard it before? The boy nodded.
I like.
Aaron studied him. He was a filthy scrag of a thing, with a thin face and dark brown hair, grinning at him in the lamplight. Belatedly, it occurred to him that the light might be visible from outside, but when he looked over his shoulder, he saw a coat hanging across the entrance to the chamber, and remembered the curtain that had brushed his face on the way in.
Safe, said Ethan, catching his thought. No Crodans.
How, Aaron couldn't think of a delicate way to say it, how have you survived here? Ethan made a face that Aaron couldn't read, a sard expression, meaningless to him.
Things I find, things people leave, when I can, I steal.
He spun an imaginary sling and let fly.
Crows.
Aaron looked at the items Ethan had collected, and wondered if those cheroots had once belonged to him and later to Grubb.
You steal from the prisoners' stashes?
He nodded.
Also from dead men, I take. And the cookhouse. Risky, though.
And it's enough?
Sard's tough. Hard to kill.
They'd have to be, Aaron thought. It seemed beyond the realms of possibility that a boy could survive undetected for so long, through the deadly winters and punishing summers, avoiding starvation and sickness and guards.
Have you been alone this whole time?
Ethan shook his head. There are others?
Them you can't see.
Aaron frowned. Ethan's grasp of Ossian was shaky. Sards were insular folk by reputation, and many never learned to speak any language but their own. He was forcing Ossian words into the grammar of his mother tongue, which made him hard to follow at times.
"You mean you don't want to show me?"
Ethan giggled.
"You can't see. In the graves they are."
He patted his chest again.
"Idral."
"Idral?" Aaron struggled to pronounce it. "What does that mean?"
"Ethan is Idral," he said enthusiastically.
Aaron was getting nowhere, and he was beginning to doubt the boy was entirely sane. Not surprising, given the circumstances. He decided to push on to the reason he'd come.
"Do you know a way out of here, Ethan?"
The boy looked uncertain. He shook his head. Aaron leaned forward.
"I do."
Ethan made no reaction, just gazed at him with those bright green eyes.
"Do you want to come with me?"
Aaron said. Ethan shook his head. Aaron frowned in surprise. He hadn't been expecting a no.
"You don't?"
Ethan bit his lip.
"Out there is the not knowing."
"Isn't that better than staying here?" Ethan shrugged and picked at a hole in the knee of his trousers.
"Here, I surviving, I eating. Out there, maybe not."
"You eat crows. You shouldn't have to steal and hide and eat birds raw. That isn't living." Ethan didn't answer. He busied himself tidying his ammunition, patting the stones into a neat pile, pretending Aaron wasn't there. Aaron watched him incredulously. He'd expected the boy to jump at the chance to leave. Would he really rather live as he was, skulking and scavenging, hiding from the Croden's notice? Who in their right mind wouldn't seize the chance to be free of that?
"You're scared," he said.
Scared of change, scared of leaving the world he knew. He saw it in the boy. Ethan shook his head with the sulky defiance of someone who really meant yes.
"I'll look after you. I'll make sure you're safe if you come with me."
Aaron held out a hand.
"You just need to be brave."
"Why?"
Ethan snapped. His face was hard with suspicion now.
"You come to graveyard, you sing. Why?"
Aaron let his hand drop. Ethan wasn't going to take it.
"I came to ask for your help," he said. "I hoped to offer you the chance of freedom in return."
"Chance to die," Ethan snorted. "Better here."
Aaron sensed he'd lost the boy's goodwill by pushing him and cursed his own stupidity. He should have been gentler.
"I'm sorry. You're right, better here. But not for me. I want to leave. Me and my friend."
"Then go!"
Ethan scrambled to the back of the cave and dug into the nest of blankets, pulling them over his head. Aaron stayed where he was, absently rubbing his arms for warmth, the acrid scent of burning oil wafting thinly around the cave. The sight of Ethan burying his head in his blankets moved him to pity. He was just a boy, and he'd been alone a long time. Aaron suspected his imaginary friends had made poor company. And yet, he needed Ethan's help. It was essential to his plan. He softened his tone and tried again.
"Ethan?"
"Go,"
Ethan demanded, his voice muffled.
"I can't, unless you help me."
Ethan unleashed a string of curses in his mother tongue. The trilling, rolling language of the Sards was ill-suited to swearing. Even their anger sounded musical.
"He's the shade of some Sard boy buried in the graveyard, and his ma got taken away. So now he wanders the camp at night, searching for her."
Jan's words, spoken on the way to the mine the day after he first saw Ethan. They came to Aaron now, and an idea came with them.
"If you don't want to leave, is there someone out there who might want to know where you are?"
Ethan shut up, and Aaron knew he'd scored a hit.
"Help me now, and when I get out, I'll..."
"No,"
Ethan snapped. Then he burst from his nest and scrambled over.
"Yes,"
he cried eagerly.
"Yes, you get out, you help Sard. Chled Nesan. What you giving me, give them." I'm not sure what you mean. Which Sard should I help?
All. Any. Find one. Offer you.
You want me to... Aaron began, but suddenly Ethan seized his hand and pulled it towards him. He put the thumb of his other hand between his teeth and bit down on it, hard enough that blood squirted out in a thin jet between his lips. Before Aaron could pull away, Ethan pressed his bloody thumb to the inside of Aaron's wrist.
Now, he said with an air of angry finality, you find. Offer you.
He took his hand away, leaving a red smear where his thumb had been. Aaron fought down his repulsion.
This is a promise? He asked.
Instead of helping you, I help another Sard. You're passing on my debt to someone who needs it? He asked.
Ethan nodded. Chled Nesan, you find.
Aaron held up his wrist to show Ethan the mark.
I promise, then, he said solemnly. My debt to you will be repaid to another Sard, but first you must help me escape.
Ethan sat in a pile of coats before him, breath steaming the air, green eyes sharp behind the matted ropes of his hair.
What are you needing?
Aaron picked up a blood-stained wing bone from the floor near where he sat and held it up.
Crows, he said. I need crows.
23. Dull evening light seeped through the mud-flecked windows of the infirmary. Unlike the longhouses, which only had shutters, there was thick glass in the frames to keep in the heat from the stove at one end. It wasn't what Cade would call warm, but it was better than freezing in his old bunk. He pulled his blankets closer as he blearily roused from a dreamless sleep. He'd become accustomed to napping through the afternoon to kill the time between lunch and dinner. They served decent food here, and while it still didn't have any meat in it, that was only for the guards, at least it came in quantity. Prisoners barely got enough to keep them alive and working, the result of some cold-blooded Croden mathematics balancing the cost of food against the cost of replacing them. Casualties had a better time of it, as the doctor insisted his patients were well fed to aid their recovery, and he obviously had some clout. 8 days had passed since the accident, 3 days short of a whole week. 8 days of nothing but eating, sleeping, and lying about, and all for the price of feigning mysterious agonies now and then. The apothecary grumbled about the amount of Draken tears Cade was consuming, but he was so disruptive when he was screaming that Kel would do anything to quiet him. The apothecary would have grumbled a lot louder if he'd known that his precious Draken tears were all going into Aaron's water flask. Soon it would be full, and Cade would have to leave. But for now, just for now, he enjoyed the luxury of being idle. The infirmary was quiet. The hectic activity after the explosion had long since died away, and most of the casualties had recovered or perished. Only a few remained, men with infections or minor breaks, or malingerers like Cade. Those with no hope of recovery were taken from the infirmary. When Cade asked Kel where they'd gone, she evaded the question and looked distressed. That was all the answer he needed. So much death, so much suffering. And yet, he blinked. Something was different. He felt all right. Ever since he'd been brought to the camp at Sulla's Bluff, he'd been greeted by despair each time he woke. Reality would sink slowly down upon him, a weight that pressed him into his bunk, weakened his muscles, turned his bones to rods of lead. His chest would become tight with cold panic, but before it could take him, there'd be a retreat into emptiness, as if all his emotion had been shorn to a stump. When he clambered reluctantly from his bunk to ready himself for the mine, he felt neither joy nor anger, but indifference and endless weariness as he went about his day, and only by nightfall would he have gathered enough sorrow to let him cry a little. That had been his life for more than 3 months now. But this evening there was no sad grey weight waiting to lay upon him. He took a breath and let it out, testing this new sensation, as if by recognizing it he might cause it to disappear, Despite everything, he felt like his old self again.
"We're getting out of here," he thought.
He should have been terrified, but he was more excited than scared. He had hope for the first time since their arrest, since before their arrest. Beyond the stockade lay true freedom and a future that didn't end in his father's workshop. They couldn't return to Shoal Point. They'd be recognized as fugitives and shot to the Iron Hand within days. What adventures they might have instead, then. Perhaps they'd join an actor's troupe. Perhaps they'd find a ship that needed a good cook and they could take to sea. He knew the risk they ran, the hardships that lay ahead, and the very real possibility of death. But they were pale threats compared to the alternative. And Aaron would have a plan. He always had a plan. A smile broke out across Cade's face, unforced and real. It felt so good he could have wept.
"Well," said Kel as she made her way through the bunks towards him, "someone's in a good mood. Feeling better?"
"Aye," said Cade. He sat up.
"Aye, I really am. Pain's been less of late. Might be I'll be good in a day or two."
"Glad to hear it," said Kel.
"The body's a marvel, ain't it? So much we don't know. But like as not, if you leave it long enough, it'll fix itself."
Her smile eased him. She had a comforting face that spoke of scones by the hearth, warm snuggles under a blanket on a cold night, tousle-haired children clambering to their places at the kitchen table. He realized he was attracted to her, and it made him blush.
"Oh, you've got some colour in your cheeks, too," Kel said. "You really are on the mend. Lucky for you. The doctor was just reading his old books for remedies."
"A hot herbal bath, a massage, that kind of thing?" Cade suggested hopefully. Kel let out her big belly laugh.
"Reckon he was thinking of something a little more stabby."
Cade winced.
"Suddenly I feel completely recovered." "You stay right there for the moment. Let's not rush things, eh? Couple more days in bed won't hurt."
She winked at him.
"I'll hold off the doctor."
Cade yawned.
"You know, after all that sleeping, I could do with a bit of a rest."
"I bet you could." She gave him a pat on the cheek, which Cade found both touchingly maternal and slightly arousing.
"I'll get you your dinner first, though."
"I'll take the pheasant with plum sauce today, I reckon."
"Ha! Huh. I think you might have to stay longer. You're obviously delirious." "Oh, I nearly forgot. Tell Aaron someone was asking for him in town."
That brought Cade up short.
Someone was asking for him?
"Aaron of Shoal Point. Seems that a stranger paid little Ed, the baker's lad, to find out if he was in the camp. Reckon it was supposed to be done on the quiet, but they picked the wrong boy. Little Ed couldn't keep his pie hole shut if the fate of the world depended on it."
"But who? Did the stranger give a name?"
Cade had no clue what to make of this news, but he sensed it was important.
"No name. I thought you might have an idea. Exciting, though, eh? Sounds like someone's come to get him out. I could tell Aaron was a high-born boy."
She saw the look on Cade's face, and her own face fell.
"I thought you'd be pleased. You and him from the same town. I just assumed you'd been put in here for the same thing. He goes free, you go free. Was I wrong?"
He didn't know. All he knew was that someone had turned up in the village asking for Aaron. Just Aaron. Cade had no connections, no money to grease the wheels. What if they were only interested in getting Aaron out and not him?
"Did little Ed say what the stranger looked like?"
Cade was desperate for any clue to make sense of it.
"Well, yes, he did," said Kel dubiously. "It just didn't sound very likely."
"What does that mean?"
"Apparently he has a big scar from here to here."
She drew a finger across her neck.
"I mean, there's only one way you get a scar like that, and there's not many that keep walking after someone cuts their throat."
Cade went cold.
"The Hollow Man does,"
he said, his voice faint. Kel only half caught what he said.
"The who?"
Cade was already clambering out of bed.
Hey, no," she cried. "You're supposed to rest."
"Ain't no need," he said distractedly as he pulled on his boots.
"I'm feeling much better. You're a miracle worker, Kel."
"But
What about those pains you've been getting?
He dug under his pillow, pulled out the water flask and stuck it in his pocket. Probably just trapped wind.
Trapped wind?
She was getting angry now.
We had to keep you sedated for a week. It was more than trapped sodden wind.
She looked around for someone to assist her, but there were no other staff nearby. Cade got to his feet. His legs felt weak from lack of use, and Kel caught him as he swayed.
Look at you! You're in no state to go anywhere!
Cade steadied himself, holding on to her arms. He became aware that they were in something like a clinch, looking into each other's eyes. His face heated.
Thank you for all you've done, he said earnestly.
Then, on a wild whim, he added, You're really pretty.
Huh?
Kel was baffled by the sudden turn in the conversation. Cade realized he'd miscalculated the moment somewhat.
Never mind, he said.
He hurried away, spurred by the awkwardness he left behind.
Trapped wind,
he called again over his shoulder, and he was out through the door. 24. It was the end of a dreary day, and the short dirt road to the south gate was busy as curfew approached. The prisoners who staffed the laundry, the workshop and the cookhouse were finishing up their duties and leaving. There was no holiday for them when the mine was closed, and they paid for their easier labour with longer hours. A few men and women from the village, nannies, servants, infirmary workers and the like, stayed overnight in the camp, but most left before darkness fell. A queue of carts had built up at the gate as they waited to be searched. Aaron and Grubb loitered on a corner, watching the activity. The Skarl had a habit of standing closer than Aaron was comfortable with. He had an unpleasantly musky smell about him, like a damp bear, but Aaron was learning to tolerate it. Since their uneasy alliance had been forged, Grubb had taken to hanging around him a lot. At first, Aaron thought it was because Grubb wanted to keep an eye on him, but he soon found the true reason. Nobody else would put up with Grubb. The smell of him was the least of it. He boasted constantly and at length of his great deeds. His sense of humour was unpleasantly cruel and revolved around vulgarity and belittling others. When he wasn't boasting or joking, he was threatening Aaron, and yet, despite his apparent dislike of the younger man, he came trailing up like an errant puppy whenever he was at a loose end. Aaron had suggested that such an important hero might have better things to do than hang about with an insignificant Ossian like himself, but Grubb hadn't taken the hint. He was annoying to be around and impossible to shake off. Aaron wondered if he'd been better as an enemy.
There he is, Aaron said.
Across the road, Tag was emerging from the cookhouse. He was followed by Gren, the stout, waddling master of the kitchen, buttoning his coat as he came. Gren was an amiable Croden with a shiny bald head and flowing black moustaches, who was always happy to ramble on about the merits of Croden cooking to any prisoner who'd listen. Even in the days when Aaron had envied all things Croden, he'd have been hard-pressed to agree that their bland, stodgy cuisine was superior to that of Ossia. Ossians knew how to eat and drink, nobody could deny that. Nobody but Gren, anyway, who possessed an evangelical spirit and sense of self-belief wildly out of proportion to his actual ability. Every day, he took on the challenge of transforming the meanest and cheapest ingredients into something that would delight the palate, and every day, he failed. Diligence, temperance, dominance. The credo of the Sanctorum and the motto of Crodens everywhere. Evidently, it didn't always work, since Gren could barely dominate a potato. But the prisoners appreciated his enthusiasm, at least. They watched Tag lock up the cookhouse and hand the key to Gren, who popped it in the pocket of his pigskin overcoat. Unlike the prisoners, people from the village got to wear clothes appropriate to the weather.
Right side pocket, same as always, Aaron said.
Same pocket always, yes, yes. Grubb not as stupid as you. Grubb take key, no problem. Grubb slip fake key in pocket. Fat man not know difference till morning.
He brandished the fake key in front of Aaron's face. It was a crude approximation they'd obtained from the workshop, cut from a splinter of metal by a prisoner Aaron had bribed with new boots. Grubb, like the others who worked on the graves, had more dead men's clothes than he knew what to do with since the explosion in the mine. Aaron eyed the key uncertainly. This was the part of the plan he wasn't sure of, mainly because it wasn't his idea. Grubb had pointed out that Gren would notice the missing key first time he put his hand in his pocket. They needed to replace it with something. "And you're sure you can do it? Take one key and slip in the other without him noticing?" Grubb's hand twitched, and the key disappeared before Aaron's eyes, as if it had vanished into thin air. The skull gave him a flat stare. "Grubb could just pick the lock, but stealing key is easier. Cookhouse got the best lock in the camp. Take time. Grubb not want to get caught. Then he have to kill many guards, things get messy." "You're a man of many talents," said Aaron. "An excellent thief and a peerless warrior."
"Grubb impresses himself sometimes. Also, he can detect sarcasm. Watch your mouth, mudslug."
Aaron couldn't help but be skeptical. He knew Skarl society forbade them to falsify their history. It was a severe crime to lie about their deeds, otherwise anyone could get themselves tattooed and call themselves a hero. There was even some kind of priesthood called the Black Triad that existed to verify their claims. But even though Grubb came from a people for whom honesty was a religion, his stories of might and valour were hard to square with this noxious bully nobody liked. "So, once you've switched the key, what then?" Aaron prompted. Grubb rolled his eyes.
"Grubb go to the graveyard, pick up the package."
"Which will be buried where?"
"Behind big cairn in northeast corner. Grubb still want to know who put package there and what's inside."
"Grubb doesn't need to know that."
"Grubb got two fists, says he does."
"Then Grubb is going to spend what's left of his life in this prison, and he'll die with half his body clean as an idiot's conscience." The beatings Aaron had taken at Grubb's hands were fresh enough that he still had some fear of the man, but he was no longer the victim he once was. Grubb's threats were empty, and he was desperate to escape. As long as Aaron refused to tell Grubb the details of his plan, he had the upper hand. Grubb bared his teeth in a snarl, but he backed down and said nothing more about his two fists. "What are Cade and I doing while you're at the graveyard?" Aaron asked, as if nothing had happened.
"You hiding in the bathhouse, which Grubb will get you into," he said pointedly, sulking. "Putting on warm coats and boots, which Grubb will give you. Meanwhile, Grubb will get package from graveyard because it less suspicious to see Grubb digging there. Seems like Grubb doing all the work."
Aaron ignored that. "We'll make a blanket rope while you're gone, and after that..."
"Grubb got your spare blankets as well. Cold in mountains. Thank you, Grubb."
Aaron gave him an "Are you finished?" look, which he'd learned from Master Fasten. "After that, it should be curfew. We'll sneak out to the cookhouse, take as much food as we can carry, and escape."
"Yes, past the dogs, who will bark and then pull our guts out like shiny sausages. Unless someone has a plan."
Grubb waited expectantly. "Someone does." Grubb muttered something unpleasant in Skarl. "So we get past the dogs. Next are the guards on the walkway," Aaron continued. His eyes lifted to the archers watching the carts passing through the south gate below them. "Ideally, we'll slip past in the fog, but if someone should see us..."
"Someone will have to kill them." "Who could it be?"
Grubb put a finger to his lower lip and looked upwards in a parody of deep thought, then gaped in mock surprise.
"Could it be Grubb?"
"That's right," said Aaron patiently.
"Using the weapons that Mudslug still hasn't got."
Aaron didn't dignify that with an answer. The man in the workshop who'd made him the fake key had promised him 3 crude blades for the extortionate price of a new coat, trousers, and socks, but it would be days before he could forge them. The weight made Aaron uneasy. At least he'd managed to get them some makeshift hooks and line for fishing. "Once we're beyond the camp, we can follow the river to Hailfell and then go our separate ways." He glanced at Grubb, hoping the Skarl didn't have any ideas about tagging along, but Grubb's attention was elsewhere. He was watching a crow that had perched on the ridge of the cookhouse roof. The crow was watching him back.
We go soon, yes?
His voice was distant.
The next fog, Aaron said.
There wasn't much sign of it, though. The weather had turned towards rain of late, and the mine would be open again in a few days. Right now they were less hungry than usual and well-rested, but that would change if they had to wait too long. They'd be in no state to run all night through the mountains if they spent all day in the tunnels. If only the mine would stay shut a while longer. If only the weapons would come quicker. If only the fog would return.
Grubb nudged him roughly with his elbow. He suppressed a scowl.
What is it?
That's your friend?
Grubb pointed, his brow creased in puzzlement. To Aaron's surprise, he saw Cade hurrying up the road from the infirmary. It was clear something was wrong. Aaron hailed him, and Cade, wary of drawing attention, walked over as fast as he could without running.
You're supposed to stay in the infirmary till the flask is full, Aaron said. There's a man in town asking for you, Cade blurted, with a scar across his throat.
He noticed Grubb, raised a hand in greeting.
Cade, pleasure. Heard a lot about you.
Grubb raised a hand in grudging half-greeting. Aaron had gone cold with shock at the news.
A scar on his throat. Like it's been cut, Aaron. Like someone cut it. The Hollow Man is here. We have to go.
Tell me exactly what you heard. His face was grim, set hard to mask his real feelings. Instinct told him that to show fear and uncertainty in front of Grubb was unwise at best, if not outright dangerous. But he could see Grubb becoming narrow-eyed with suspicion as Cade finished his tale.
Who this Hollow Man? What he want with you?
He's come to kill me, thought Aaron in terror.
His father had warned him about the Hollow Man all his life. What he'd thought was a tale to scare a child was no tale at all, but real, and just beyond those walls. Now all those nightmares came swarming out of the past.
We're not waiting for the fogs, he said. We're going tomorrow night, whatever the weather.
Grubb looked worried.
Tomorrow night, blood moon.
Exactly, said Aaron.
He hadn't known that until Grubb said it, but he adapted quickly.
Lyssa won't be in the sky. By Tantera's light alone, it'll be hard to see. We can slip past the archers then.
Grubb crossed his arms stubbornly.
Blood moon bring bad luck. Spirits come out to play, everyone know that. Only stupid men travel on blood moon. Grubb think this is bad idea.
A long shriek echoed through the drab evening, coming from the peaks, mournful and unutterably sad.
Even horrible thing in mountains think it bad idea, Grubb added.
Am I hearing you right? Aaron asked.
Aren't you Grubb, the great warrior? Grubb, who slayed 10 Elleru single-handed? Grubb, who bedded a Harish noblewoman and escaped a household of angry guards when her husband came home? Grubb, who took on an ice bear and won?
Yes, Grubb cried. Yes, that was Grubb.
Didn't you slay a whole shipload of Boscan smugglers? Didn't you fight in the 6th purge against the Urds and live to tell of it?
Yes, Grubb did all those things.
He beat his chest with his fist.
And is this mightiest of warriors scared of children's stories about ghosts and shades coming out on a blood moon?
Yes. Wait, no. Grubb punch ghosts in the face.
Aaron slapped him on the shoulder with as much manful swagger as he could muster.
That's what I wanted to hear. I'll see you on the morrow. Be ready.
He strode away quickly, leaving Grubb standing on the corner. By the time the Skarl realized that Aaron had never answered his question about the Hollow Man, Aaron had gone. Cade caught him up a few dozen yards down the road.
"Was that the same feller who was pounding your chops in a week ago?"
he asked in amazement.
"You just have to know how to talk to people,"
Aaron said.
"Have you got the flask?"
Cade patted his pocket.
"It's nearly full, though I'll own a fair bit of it as my slobber."
"It'll serve," said Aaron. He was flint-eyed with purpose. They'd set their course now, and it had all become very real.
"Are we really going to do this?"
Cade asked.
"Escape? I mean, if the Hollow Man's here for you, maybe you're safer inside."
"Whoever the Hollow Man is, my father was scared to death of him," Aaron said. "If he's found me, he can get to me." He didn't know how it would happen, but he knew with certainty that it would. a prisoner bribed to poison him, an arrow from the trees as they marched to the mine? Or could the Hollow Man walk through walls as in Aaron's nightmares, a shade not subject to the limitations of human flesh? Would Aaron wake in the night to find his murderer standing by his bunk, a blade in his hand, the wound in his throat gaping?
If you ever see the Hollow Man, you run. You run and you don't stop.
His father knew of the Hollow Man. His advice was to run. Aaron thought it good counsel. "There's something I need to do before curfew," said Aaron, fear making him brusque. "I'll see you back at the longhouse." "Aaron," Cade stopped him with a hand on his shoulder. Aaron saw the look on his face and softened. Cade was as scared as he was.
"We're going to make it," Aaron assured him. "When the sun rises the day after tomorrow, it'll find us free."
"Aye," said Cade. "One way or another."
Aaron clasped his forearm, and Cade clasped his in return, and Aaron pulled him into a fierce Ossian hug.
It felt like what men did, and it made them feel like men. No words could do more.
Aaron headed off, his mind a whirl. There was a bigger story here, he was certain of it. The Hollow Man, his father's secrets, that glimpse of Clisson in the windows of the overseer's mansion, unsettled animals in the village, sightings of a druid in the forest. Somehow, it was all connected. If he lived past tomorrow night, he'd find out how. First, though, he was going to the graveyard to leave a little crowbone charm by a cairn, where Ethan had told him to place it. The thought of the boy saddened him. Aaron had no love for Sards, but still, it was hard to leave him in a place like this. The tragedy of it was that Ethan didn't want to leave, that he was too scared of what was beyond the limits of his tiny world to act. Aaron would have tried to persuade him again, but he'd seen nothing of him since that strange night in the fog. He'd gone back during the day, but had been unable to find Ethan's cave. There were several places where trees grew thick against the cliffs, but none looked quite right, and he didn't want to endanger the boy by investigating too closely. Singing wouldn't work either. Ethan would only be found if he wanted to be. He rubbed his thumb against the mark on the inside of his wrist, the mark left by Ethan to seal the promise Aaron had made. Blood against skin, that was all it was. And yet, no matter how hard Aaron wiped or rubbed it, it refused to come off. 25. Gren the cook was a man of impressive girth, and Grubb had to crash into him with considerable force to knock him over.
"Oh, Grubb very sorry," he cried.
He'd gone down with Gren and was now struggling to get to his feet while trying to pull Gren up at the same time.
"Grubb not look where he going."
"That's all right, just an accident, no harm done," said Gren with forced patience, trying to extricate himself from the tangle of Grubb's arms. The road to the south gate was always busy near the end of the day, and some of the other prisoners were smirking at his misfortune.
"Cookman not hurt?"
Grubb straightened the sleeves of his overcoat for him.
"Grubb got mud on Cookman's coat."
"Don't concern yourself," said Gren, stepping away. "It'll wash out." He smoothed his moustaches, raised his chin and put on a smile.
"Those are some magnificent tattoos," he observed.
"They tell story of Grubb's mighty deeds. This one mean..."
He was interrupted by a blow.
"Get out of here, you clumsy skull freak," the guard said in Croden.
Grubb glowered and slunk away, holding his ear.
"Was there any need for that?" Gren asked. "It was an accident."
"Do I tell you how to cook?" snapped the guard.
Aaron, who'd been loitering nearby, detached himself from the wall of the laundry and slipped away from the road into the alleys between the close-packed buildings. It was another grey day, and steely clouds hid the highest peaks of the mountains. Cade had told him that he'd been praying to Johor for fog to cover their escape, but if the Heron King heard him, he'd been ignored. At least they had clouds to obscure the stars and mute the weak red glow of the cracked moon. It would be dark tonight, very dark. That would have to suffice. He'd barely slept last night, kept awake by a cocktail of excitement and nerves. His mind raced with plans, and it was a long time before he felt tired enough to close his eyes. When he did, he imagined the Hollow Man standing by his bed, and they flew open again. But dawn found him still alive, and he managed to doze for a while before First Bell roused them for breakfast. He found Grubb among the longhouses, at the corner where they'd agreed to meet after his encounter with Gren. Cade was already there. "Do you have it?" he asked Grubb. "Ha!" said Grubb, producing the key. "Easy. Fat man not notice anything." He winced and rubbed the side of his head. "Grubb going to get that guard, though. Rip his throat out and stuff it up his nose." Aaron wasn't certain that was even possible. It was well done, anyway. He held out his hand for the key. Aha! Grubb thinks he'll hold on to this, just in case. The key disappeared back into his pocket. Aaron felt a flash of anger. You don't trust me? Nope, said Grubb with brutal honesty. And Mudslug doesn't trust Grubb. That's why Grubb still doesn't know half the plan. Reckon that's fair enough, said Cade quickly, seeking to defuse the confrontation he saw coming. We're all in this together, ain't we? Let him keep the key. Cade was right. They'd never actually agreed that Aaron would keep the key. Aaron just didn't like Grubb's defiance. He needed everyone to stick to the plan, and the Skarl's temperament made him a liability. But this was a battle he didn't need to fight, so he let it pass. Fine, he said. Let's go. We have a lot to do. The bathhouse was tucked away in the southwest corner of the compound, where the river ran up close against the stockade. It was locked when not in use. Stone walls and a stout door secured by a padlock and chain kept prisoners out. They stopped at the corner. Nobody was around, and the surrounding buildings obscured the archer's view. Grubb slipped up to the door and pulled on the handle. It opened a short way before the chain stopped it, just enough for Aaron and Cade to slip through.
"Padlock looks sturdy," Grubb told them. "Cheap, though. Grubb know the kind. Pop open easy if you know how."
He'd been here earlier in the day, opened the padlock, and moved it further down the chain. The bathhouse still looked secure, but the chain was now slack on the handles.
"Grubb go to graveyard now. Fetch package like good little errand boy," he said, once Aaron and Cade were inside.
He glared at them suspiciously through the gap between door and jamb.
"It better be worth it."
He pulled the door shut, and they were alone.
"That feller's actually pretty handy to have around," Cade observed once he'd gone.
"You haven't spent the last week trying to scrape him off," Aaron said. "We'll dump him the moment we get to Hailfell." They were in a bare grey antechamber, with wooden cubbyholes built along one side. Here the prisoners would strip and stash their clothes before heading to the bath beyond. Aaron had never been in here when it was empty before, and he felt the thrill of trespassing. "At the back," he said, Cade reminded him, and walked into the bathing chamber. Aaron followed warily, half suspecting an ambush. The bathing chamber wasn't large. The smallest pool in the public baths in Shoal Point had been bigger. Tiled walls chilled air that was already cold, and high, narrow windows did little to lighten the gloom. Water dripped from the ceiling, stealthy, wet plinks and taps echoing in the hollow space. In the centre was the rectangular bath, empty now. Sluices at either end were used to fill it from the river and drain it again. Many a bathing prisoner had wished they could exit as easily as the water did, but the sluices were covered with iron grills and far too small to crawl through. Cade skirted the pool to the far corner, where brooms and mops and pails leaned untidily. He dug among them and pulled out a hemp sack. Aaron checked the back rooms to be satisfied nobody was hiding there, and returned to find Cade pawing through the contents of the sack.
"Looks like he was as good as his word," Cade said, holding up a coat.
He pulled out a pair of woolen gloves.
"Gloves? Nine, I didn't dare to dream of gloves."
Here were the clothes Grubb had promised,
taken from the dead. The shirts and thin coats were a pitiful defence against the cold, but they were more effective when layered. Some were blood-stained and torn, and they reeked of old sweat, urine, and something worse, the acrid taint of death, which Ossians called Sala's perfume. But none of that was anything to Aaron and Cade, who'd endured too much to wrinkle their noses at a few bad smells. They buttoned up coats on top of coats, pulled trousers over trousers excitedly. "I think I'm warming up," said Cade. "I'd forgotten how that felt." "When we get to Hailfell, you'll forget what hungry feels like, too." Aaron was sitting on the floor, levering off his boots. "First thing we'll do is find an inn and buy a dish of meat."
"Oh, don't," Cade begged. "Delicious, delicious flesh. You know how long it's been since I ate something that had a heartbeat?"
"Proper bread, made from actual wheat and warm from the oven," Aaron said. "Thick, dark ale. Hold trout as long as your arm, cooked in butter and herbs with golden potatoes." Cade groaned and shoveled imaginary food into his mouth with both hands. "Wild boar in truffle sauce, streak eggs and capers, bacon." Aaron got his boot off at last, and a hiss of pain escaped him, interrupting his culinary fantasies. The socks beneath were worn to a webbing, the skin of his foot raw with blisters, his little toe bruised blue. The smile fell from Cade's face, and Aaron knew he was remembering that night when Aaron had brought him a cheese roll and new thick socks for the winter, traded for cheroots he'd taken from a dead man. "Aaron," he began.
"Doesn't feel as bad as it looks," Aaron lied.
"Don't worry about it."
"No, I need to say it. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry about before."
Aaron waved it away.
"You were having a bad time."
"No, that's..." He struggled with what to say. Real apologies never came easily, especially among friends.
"That ain't an excuse. I shouldn't have said that stuff. You always had my back, and no one else ever did."
"We've always had each other's," said Aaron, "and we always will.
You could have left me behind in the mine. I didn't deserve what you did."
"I'll never leave you behind, Cade," said Aaron. "Never." Cade turned away and made out he had something in his eye.
"Well," he said. "Well."
But his voice wobbled and he went no further. Aaron picked out some new socks and eased them over his toes.
"You know, if you're ready, there are blankets in the sack that need knotting into a rope," he said casually.
"Aye," said Cade. "Aye, I'll get right to it."
He set to work, glad of the distraction, and neither of them said anything else until they heard the chain clink on the bathhouse door and Grubb stormed in.
"What is this?" he shouted, holding up a small dirty sack. He tossed it to the ground, and its contents tumbled out.
"Those," said Aaron, getting to his feet, "are crows. Nice fresh ones, killed and plucked just last night."
He felt a flood of relief at the sight. Ethan had honoured his side of the deal.
"Mad slug not se package full of dead crows?"
"I didn't say it wasn't," Aaron pointed out. "Why are you angry?"
"Crows are eyes of Urgotha, bone god. Not supposed to kill crows."
"I didn't know that,"